Today marks 12 weeks to Presidential Election Day in November. Hillary Clinton campaigned in Pennsylvania yesterday with Vice President Joe Biden and pitched herself as the champion of the middle class. Donald Trump shifted his focus from criticizing Clinton to foreign policy, saying he'd end what he calls America's current strategy of nation building. In his speech yesterday, he also called for a new ideological test for anyone wanting to immigrate to the U.S.
The time is overdue to develop a new screening test for the threats we face today. I call it extreme vetting.
So, for a look at the race this morning, we're joined by State Representative Jeff Deal, a Republican and Trump campaign co-chair in Massachusetts. Good morning, Jeff, and thanks for coming in.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
We're also joined by Boston City Councilor-at-Large Ayanna Pressley, who was a Clinton delegate at the Democratic National Convention last month. Good morning to you, and welcome to the studio.
Good morning.
So let me ask the first question. Does yesterday's speech on foreign policy signal that Donald Trump has turned a corner and will now largely stay focused on the issues instead of bashing Clinton and the media?
Look, I think this is the second major policy speech he's given. This was obviously on international affairs, and he also spoke last week on economic issues. So I think you're seeing Donald Trump do exactly what he said he was going to do, which was provide the public the policy plans that he has once he becomes president.
Ayanna?
Well, you know, I would just argue that, you know, very often in an election season, voters are skeptical that a candidate will make good on the promises that they're espousing while campaigning. I'm worried that Donald Trump will make good on every promise that he's made. Yesterday's policy speech, shows he's getting a little bit more adept in using a teleprompter. But, you know, as far as foreign policy, he does not instill any confidence in me as to his competence or a real plan. He never speaks to the how. And I find what he did outline to be shallow and incredibly alarming. And in fact, when he talked about an extreme vetting for our immigrants, anyone who is hostile to the American people or our ideals, I think he would not even pass that vetting because I find him to be incredibly hostile to the American people and our ideals.
You want to respond to that, Jeff?
Well, nobody's as good as the teleprompter as our current president of the United States. But I'll tell you what, I think Donald Trump was saying, look, we want to have people come into our country who believe in America, want to contribute to America, people who are friendly to the LGBT community, people who are more accepting of women being equal. And I think that was his concern, is that we're getting people coming in from countries that don't necessarily believe in that. And secondly, we're having people coming in with Syrian refugees that have now been pointed out by the CIA as potential terrorists.
But Jeff, you know that there's a segment of GOP voters and others who worry that Trump, since he's undisciplined and erratic, think they're witnessing character flaws that make them wonder whether he's qualified for the job.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of
openly questioned right now.
A lot of these people are, I think, former Bush appointees. But I'll tell you, the other thing, too, is a lot of Republicans are going to come home when they realize, obviously, the significance of the Supreme Court appointees. And on top of that, I think Donald Trump is in that phase where after Labor Day, when people start paying attention, he is going to be basically going between here and November and explaining why he can and will make America great again.
All right.
Well, I would just say, you know, as a matter of judgment, ultimately, you know, this isn't about Trump's judgment anymore because we know that he's reckless, he's bombastic, he's unfit, he's temperamentally he's unfit. This is about the judgment of the American people, and he's tanking in the polls because they are waking up.
Hillary Clinton, we've heard a number of Democrats complain that she's spending too much time focusing on why one should not vote for Trump and not enough making her own positive case for her own campaign, explaining her vision. Do you see that?
Oh, not at all. I think in her vision, she's done a wonderful job at articulating it and in rolling out very specific policy plans, which are not only resonating with the Democratic Party, but also many independents and Republicans. I think the fact that, you know, her support is growing really does speak to the resonance and the strength of her platform. And she's not new to this. I mean, she's the most vetted candidate. And she's also been the most mischaracterized and maligned. So she has had to be pointed and specific in her plans and what she would do as president.
Jeff?
I have no idea what her policies are, except for that it's an extension of the last 8 years of the Obama administration, which has given us 1.2% economic growth in the last four quarters, which is basically taking us nowhere as a country. Her work as Secretary of State and foreign policy has left the international world in shambles. I mean, and then as far as reckless, you know, she was advised not to use a personal email server. She used it. She has clearly misled people on that. And so I think that obviously her judgment is clearly in question. I think Donald Trump will be pointing that out as we get closer to November in these upcoming debates.
The American people have moved on from emails and those predictable attacks. I mean, there's been exhaustive investigations and they've been unfounded and baseless. You know, what the American people care about, especially now, is feeling safe and secure. And that's domestically and internationally. And Hillary Clinton will do that. What I know for sure, even if I couldn't outline every single policy, but I can outline enough that are important to me. But even if I couldn't outline every single one, I know she is not paying footsie with our enemies and she's not in bed with the NRA.
The other fresh criticism by Democrats of Hillary Clinton, as we saw in the New York Times this week, is that in openly courting Republicans turned off by Trump, it feels as if Hillary Clinton is moving to the center and away from a progressive and or liberal agenda. You're looking as if you question that.
Oh, I don't agree with that at all. I think, you know, again, it speaks to how inclusive her message is. I mean, she's not abandoned anything. It also speaks to the incompetence of Trump's campaign, that so many, you know, stalwart leaders within the party and leaders in the intelligence community just can't in good conscience have this man, who is a president in waiting, have access to nuclear codes.
It's not quite Labor Day yet. Traditionally, when voters start paying close attention to the election, will the debates this fall ultimately decide this contest?
I think absolutely. I mean, look, both have made this, you know, case to their bases. Hillary Clinton, it's clear from the emails that have been leaked, and there'll be more coming, I think, but the fact that she's been colluding with the Democratic Party, to get the nomination, that's going to turn off an awful lot of Sanders voters. They're going to, I think, keep an open mind between Donald Trump or Jill Stein, maybe even Gary Johnson. But I think that the debates will clearly define the difference between the two.
Ayanna, are you concerned that since she's so far ahead in the polls right now that the Clinton campaign could get overly confident?
Never.
A number of Democrats and analysts expressing this concern.
No, absolutely not. The secretary, having been one of the most mischaracterized, maligned, misunderstood political figures in the 21st century, she's never operated with a sense of entitlement in this race, in this endeavor. That is why she is running a 50-state strategy. That is why she has, you know, a strong grassroots organization in all those states. She's not taking anything for granted at all because she knows what's at stake, and that's the safety and the security of the American people.
Clinton supporter, Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley, thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you for having us.
State Representative Jeff Deal, Republican, Trump supporter, thank you for coming in this morning.
Bob, I appreciate the time.
A new report issued by a nonprofit group responsible for protecting the rights of people with disabilities outlines cases of neglect and abuse of special needs students at a residential school in the town of Middleborough. The Chamberlain International School is one of 56 residential special education schools in this state. This school serves students with conditions that are often too difficult for public schools to address. The Boston-based Disability Law Center says the school has failed to prevent students from trying to harm themselves and from fleeing campus. Private special education schools such as Chamberlain are also the focus of a recently completed investigation by WBUR and the investigative news agency, The Eye. This morning, WBUR's Shannon Dooling reports on the challenges these schools face and the allegations leveled against the Chamberlain School.
White fences and stone walls line the campus of the Chamberlain International School in Middleborough. The school is tucked away on nearly 20 acres of land, about 30 miles south of Boston. Many of the school buildings are converted colonial-style houses, painted a crisp white and adorned with dark green shutters. On the day of our visit, the grounds are immaculately manicured with giant peonies in full bloom. The serene environment is strategically manufactured to an extent. School officials say it's meant to be a calm place for a student body craving normalcy.
We do not like to stigmatize our students, but all of them have come to us after a long history of placements outside of their home, outside of public school. Many have been through psychiatric hospitalizations.
Sarah Norfleet is the Director of Marketing and Communications at Chamberlain.
we see our students as really bright, unique individuals who have incredible strengths, who have, you know, incredible challenges that they've had to face, lifelong challenges.
There are more than 100 students at Chamberlain, ranging in age from 11 to 22 years old. Most of them live on campus, and they're a combination of in-state, out-of-state, and international students. The young people at Chamberlain represent a wide range of diagnoses, including autism, severe anxiety and depression, and self-injurious behavior like cutting. Stan Eichner is head litigator at the Disability Law Center. In its report issued yesterday, the group concludes that Chamberlain is, in some ways, ill-equipped to handle the complex needs of its students.
This is a private school, very much focused on students with emotional behavioral disabilities. And despite that being the group for which the school is designed, the law center found that there were these problems with how these students are treated.
Problems like failing to prevent student suicide attempts and cutting, inadequately supervising students leading to repeat runaways from campus, failing to properly investigate cases of bullying, as well as verbal and emotional abuse by some staff. The Law Center is a Boston-based nonprofit with federal authority to protect the rights of people with disabilities. It has been investigating Chamberlain for more than a year after receiving complaints of what it called in a court filing serious allegations of abuse and neglect by staff against students. Eichner says the organization found some of the allegations to be without merit. WBUR and The I spoke with almost two dozen parents and relatives of current and former students of the school, including Renee Mazur.
I do not trust Chamberlain to take care of my son.
The Law Center investigation was spurred in part by complaints from Mazur, who lives in the Philadelphia area. Her youngest son is on the autism spectrum and has been at Chamberlain for over 2 years now.
Every time my phone rings, I'm scared I'm going to get a call that he's dead or in a hospital somewhere.
At the request of the boy's father, who retains sole custody of the 17-year-old, we've agreed not to identify the boy. According to a report from the Department of Early Education and Care obtained by WBUR and The I, the boy was hospitalized for 4 days. State investigators say the boy appears to have ingested an unprescribed medication. The Law Center's report cites several instances of medication error at the school. No names are used, but one case matches the experience of Mazur's son. The Law Center report says the student was found unresponsive and sent to a local hospital before being transferred to Boston. It also says the student had a strong, non-prescribed antipsychotic medication in their system. Chamberlain's program director, Diane Wilson, says the school conducted an internal investigation into the boy's hospitalization, but could not pinpoint the source of the substance.
We were not able to determine how the student could have obtained the medication that was in question. What's important to note is that we're the ones who supplied the hospital with that information. We asked them to test for a wide variety of medications because we were concerned about the student's safety.
Investigators from the Massachusetts Department of Early Education and Care told the school it needed to reevaluate its policy around administering meds. The school says its medication error rate is now lower than most local hospitals. Some of Mazur's allegations were among those deemed to be without merit by the Law Center. Her son remains at Chamberlain International School. The boy's father declined to comment on why. Opinions on just how well Chamberlain meets the needs of its students depend somewhat on whom you ask. School officials connected reporters with several parents who consider Chamberlain to be a second home for their children. Take Laura Matichera of Haynesport, New Jersey.
Chamberlain has been the most successful with her. They work with her and her type of population excellent, and they're just I can't say anything bad about them.
We've agreed not to name Matichera's 19-year-old daughter in order to protect her medical privacy. After her daughter spent time in and out of a New Jersey State psychiatric hospital, Matichera says the family fought to get the girl back at Chamberlain, where she'd had great success in 2013. Matichera's daughter is now a residential student at the school.
We knew we wanted her there. She wanted to be back there, so truthfully, you can sleep at night because you know where your child is. When she was in a state hospital, I worried. I know she's getting appropriate care, and they're caring at Chamberlain.
But the school also has its critics.
Don't put your child at Chamberlain. If you want them to be safe, cared for, and respected, I would keep looking for another school.
Jacqueline Dinan from Pembroke, New Hampshire, sent her 13-year-old son to Chamberlain in 2014. The boy has a diagnosis of high-functioning autism and a condition similar to bipolar disorder. When her son aged out of his special ed school in New Hampshire, Dinan looked for a new school. As part of that process, she says she looked online for news reports about abuse at schools, or anything alarming, as she puts it. Some licensing reports for private special ed schools are published online, but those reports do not include any history of allegations or documented cases of mistreatment at a school. Dinan now counts her son among those cases of mistreatment investigated by the Disability Law Center. She says another student sexually harassed her son, and staff excessively restrained and even slapped the boy in the face. The Law Center findings reiterate what Dinan shared with reporters, saying that after slapping her son, a staff member asked others to take over before she did something to get herself fired. On top of that, Dinan's son experienced what she says was a traumatic altercation with a female staff member at Chamberlain. The dispute is mentioned in the Law Center's findings as an example of verbal abuse inflicted by staff on students. Dinan's son told her over the phone what he alleged the staff member said.
He said that she said, "When you're older and you're in prison, you're not going to be able to speak because you're going to have a dick in your mouth."
The Chamberlain School would not respond to that allegation, citing student privacy. Shortly after that altercation, Dinan says her son ran away from campus, navigating the heavy woods for almost 2 hours before a school staff member picked him up on the side of Route 18, almost a mile and a half from the main campus. According to a Middleborough police report from that day, the school did not notify the police of a missing child, as school policy requires when staff loses sight of a student. Instead, a concerned citizen called police when a boy emerged from the woods looking, quote, disheveled and dirty. In a written statement, Chamberlain's communications director says in the case of Dinan's son, the boy temporarily left campus and returned with faculty assistants. She says staff followed proper procedures. But in that same police report from October of last year, the officer notes that was the third time in a month that he helped look for a missing Chamberlain student. He says it was the second runaway he was personally involved with, in which the school failed to notify police.
My son just left the grounds and started running through people's yards, he told me, and I didn't know he was gone.
Dinan says the school contacted her only after her son was back on campus, almost 2 hours after he left. The next day, she pulled her son from Chamberlain, and this past May, shared her complaints with the Law Center. One of the main findings of neglect in the Law Center's report focuses on several other cases of students leaving campus unsupervised. Eric McLeish is the attorney representing the school. He says his primary objection with the report is that it was prepared by attorneys unqualified to make such determinations.
This was an investigation that was not based upon objective fact-finding, but was designed to embarrass the school, to close the school. And the really troubling part of it is that the people that are making these judgments are public interest attorneys, but not state regulators, and most importantly, not the parents of these children.
WBUR and the I reviewed investigation reports by the Department of Early Education and Care, confirming 33 instances over 20 years in which Chamberlain was found to be non-compliant with state regulations. The reports document use of overly aggressive and improper restraints, sexual abuse and harassment by staff, and neglect. Chamberlain officials point out that they self-reported 30 of the 33 cases in which the state asked the school to take corrective action. This includes two separate reports of improper sexual relations between staff and students. Charles Conroy ran a private residential special ed school in Lancaster for 30 years. Conroy chuckles when asked what might be considered a normal number of complaints at a special ed school.
There is no normal. You work with children with these complex kinds of issues, and sometimes they'll make allegations that are baseless. I had situations where a kid would make an allegation 2-3 times a day, and each time I'd say, file on it. You have to file on it.
But there's no way of easily comparing Chamberlain's record to similar schools. There's no central database analyzing these numbers. Conroy says as state-mandated reporters of allegations of abuse and neglect, special education schools' records can be viewed one of two ways.
The number of allegations against the program can be looked at certainly as a weakness, but it also can be looked as a strength. Someone who's got low numbers doesn't necessarily mean it's a better program. It might, quite the contrary, mean that they just don't file when they should.
Chamberlain prides itself on a long history of vigilant filing practices, dating back to its opening in 1976, shortly after the state passed the special ed law for students with disabilities. The school says transparency and the safety of its students are of the utmost concern. State agencies say Chamberlain International School's status and licenses are currently in good standing, but the agencies are reviewing the Disability Law Center's report. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Shannon Dooling.
It's a bittersweet day today for the family of a Korean War veteran from Cambridge. Corporal Ronald Sparks died in a North Korean prisoner of war camp, but his remains went missing for six decades. Back in June, using DNA, the military identified a previously unidentified soldier buried at the National Memorial Cemetery in Hawaii as Ronnie Sparks. Today, those remains returned to his family following a procession through Cambridge. Corporal Sparks' nephew, Bob Sparks, has spent the last decade trying to find his uncle and recalled the day his remains were identified using DNA.
After the Army transferred a lot of the remains that were in Korea to Hawaii, where they had set up a state-of-the-art, lab to check everything, including DNA now, that's where there was real hope. And, they took samples of DNA first from my son because I was overseas in London visiting my daughter, and I came home to learn that my son's DNA had matched one of the skeletons, one of the remains, and that, in fact, it was Ron.
You know, as I understand it, you met your uncle just once a very long time ago. You were only 3 years old. What do you remember? If anything, what stands out?
Well, what stood out at the time was waking up, seemingly in the middle of the night. I didn't know what time it was. At three, I felt a little frightened, but I knew that if I ran into the other room, my parents would either be sitting listening to the radio in the living room or in bed. So I rushed out to find them, and they weren't in the living room where I expected to find them, but sitting in the corner reading a newspaper was an individual in a what I took to be a military uniform reading the paper. I was a little bit startled, and I said, "Who are you?" And he said, "I'm your Uncle Ron. I'm your father's little brother." And he swept me up in his arms and gave me a hug.
How long after that, before he disappeared while in action?
It was probably within a year.
He disappeared in 1951. What did your family know?
Initially, we knew nothing. The way we found out is I was walking down the sidewalk hand in hand with my mother, going to visit grandmother, and I saw my mother take an envelope out of the mailbox in front of my grandmother's house and immediately burst into tears. And it was the telegram that said, "Your son was missing in action and presumed dead."
As I understand it, your grandparents and your father always held out some hope for the return of his remains.
Of his remains, exactly. I remember my grandfather asking my father, and this is through my father, I was much too young to be part of the conversation, but my grandfather asked my father to do whatever he could to find out what happened to his body, where are his remains, please bring him home so we can have a proper burial, here at home.
Is that what drove you all these years, that family wish that the remains of your uncle come home? Is that what has driven you all these years?
Well, I have to say, I heard it from my grandparents telling my father, but it was my father telling me on his deathbed that he wanted me to do it, that he'd done everything in his power, and he said, "I want you to do everything you can, no matter how long it takes or what you have to do." He asked me in his deathbed to promise that I would bring Ronnie home.
Is there solace in finality?
I want to tell you, there is. I'm sure you can read the stress in my voice, and it's terribly emotional. It's terribly bittersweet. I am going to be so joyful when I go to Cambridge City Hall and meet all those wonderful people that want to pay tribute to that young teenage boy from the streets of Cambridge that sacrificed his life. And it's going to be terribly sad, as I am right now, but I'm going to be so joyous when I see his flag-draped coffin laid to rest at Woodlawn Cemetery next to his parents, who never had the comfort of knowing where their boy was. And Friday, they're going to find out that he's finally home.
Well, Bob, congratulations to you for accomplishing a life's goal, and all of Greater Boston, I'm sure, is wishing you and your family well in welcoming back the remains of your uncle.
Thank you very, very much, sir.